Well, good evening. Another night here at the Mead House, and I was just telling the guys, I'm not in the best of moods tonight, but we're going to try to suffer through this thing. I did something to my back yesterday, and it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you have this little feeling, this little twinge, little thing, and you know what's going to happen 24 hours from then. And, you know, you get to that point where you just, you know, you can't roll out of bed and all that. Anyway, that's where I'm at tonight. So, hey, again, welcome to the Mead House. Hi, and we're going to continue on down this braggart path. Last week, we had Michael Fairbrother on from Moonlight Meadery, and wow, opened a lot of eyes, a lot of good information from Michael, and again, thanks to Mike for appearing on the show with us. But first off, you know, and again, I apologize, I didn't get out to Facebook. Chris and I were talking, he called yesterday, and we got to talking about chocolate nibs and what to do and how to use them and whatnot. And so I spent a couple hours looking at all kinds of information about chocolate nibs and, you know, how they're used in beer brewing, mead making, and what have you. So we're going to be talking about that tonight. Ryan's got some pretty good ideas on a kind of a different method of either creating a beer wort or an addition to for a mead. But we'll talk about that here in a little while and straighten that all out for you. Hey, the call-in number tonight, 818-921-4680. If you want to give us a holler, we're located at themeadhouse.com. That's where we live. And, of course, we do have the Facebook deal, which is picking up quite a bit of traffic lately. And you simply just go to the Mead House on Facebook. The crew tonight, Ryan Richardson in the house, Aaron Martins, he's off gallivanting around, Slovenia, or where was it he was headed?
I thought Switzerland.
Switzerland, that's it. Mississippi.
I'm jealous.
What? Yeah.
Oh, you know he's going to come back with a boatload of mead, too.
Oh, you think? Mississippi.
If he can get it through customs, he's going to be loaded down.
And that's Mississippi Chris Spencer right there. Jeff Schaus in the house. My name's J.D. Webb. And boys, I've been drinking some today. Well,
what's in your cup?
Yeah, what's in my cup? Well, I got an early start on my red wine. Now, this goes back to my cardiologist whose instructions to me was that I must drink a glass of red wine a day, and that's what I've been doing. Not that I've had a whole lot, but I'm drinking a Hecker Pass Winery. It's called Red Velvet. It's a blend, very dry but very fruit forward. We tasted this. This is a private vineyard. It's a private family. They bottle it right there at the estate. And really good stuff. He's an award-winning vintner. Came here from Italy. We're talking probably back in the 30s and 40s. We kind of stumbled across his winery on the way home from up north here in California, and stopped in, had some sips of some of his wines, and we came home with several bottles of his wines. This one tonight, Red Velvet. This is from Hecker Pass Winery up in the Santa Clara Valley. So, Ryan, what's in your cup tonight, bud?
Well, I am drinking a... It's a technically, I guess, it's a beer. It's kind of along. I was inspired to pick it up along the lines of the braggart. It's called. You know, I live in the Northeast neighborhood. It's, you know, just called Northeast. And this particular beer is called Northeast Nectar, and it's described as a honey Kolsch. And the description says that it is a a pale, light-bodied ale, clean and refreshing, fermented clean, and then with copious amounts of honey added at the end of the batch. You know, it's supposed to give it a little bit of a sweeter character. It's a great beer. I'm not getting any honey out of it. I went in thinking that I was going to get more honey flavor, honey aroma, but it's just like drinking a real nice, very nice, clean, light-bodied ale. It's got beautiful color, but I'm just not getting any honey out of it. Maybe as it warms up a little bit, I'll get a little bit more. But again, I wanted to try that out, being that it's not really a Braggot, but it's at least along those lines of where a brewery might go by adding some honey.
There you go. Sounds interesting. Mississippi, is that dark Italian roast I smell?
Not. It will be in a little bit. I've been on sort of a beer education this week.
There you go.
Because I really wanted to make a good Braggot, and I think it's ridiculous to think that you could make a good Braggot if you can't make a good beer. So I've been trying to educate myself on it, and which is kind of boring. It's kind of like being forced to study English when you just want to be a football coach. I've got a Samuel Smith organic chocolate stout, and exploring all the different dark styles. So I think that's probably where I'm going to end up going with another Braggot, because I found out that I'm not a fan of extremely bitter beers. I tried an Imperial Stout that had a IBU of 75, I believe it was, way too much for me. And this Irish Red Ale is going to have 65. So while it may be good for a lot of people, I discovered that I'm not a hophead. So I'm probably going to be looking at something like a chocolate milk stout or something like that to try to do a Braggot with. So I'm trying this chocolate stout. Pretty good.
So you're getting some chocolate out of it? I mean,
oh man, this thing is running over with chocolate. It's on the nose and on the flavor and everything, and I'm almost inclined to believe that they used some sort of artificial chocolate flavoring in this, even though it says it's all organic chocolate. But my gosh, I don't know how they would have gotten this much out of it. But the good thing is I'm not that far off from having my cup of coffee, because this has got a lot of coffee coming through. So
okay.
It's
good.
Real smooth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jeff, what's in your cup tonight, my friend?
Well, since we're talking Braggots, I decided to give myself an early preview of my little Saison Braggot project here. It's been bottle carbonating for about 3 weeks. And, it needs more bottle carbonation. It's hardly got any head on it whatsoever. But it's still pretty good. It's an interesting project in that a lot of the beer qualities are right up front. You get that hoppiness, right on the start, along with some of that yeast character from the Saison yeast. And the finish is really a dry mead finish rather than a beer finish. So it's kind of an interesting progression as you taste it.
Wow, sounds good. While we're on the while we're talking chocolate, Chris called me yesterday, and we had a discussion about chocolate, and he's going to be working on this chocolate milk thing that he wants to do for his Braggot. So our discussion was about you know, what I did with chocolate and, you know, how did I use it and whatnot. And, you know, we were talking about the different ways of dealing with the cocoa nibs themselves. And, you know, his question was, you know, if I had, I don't know, what was your question? Remind me. I can't even.
Well,
think.
I wanted to know how you had treated them.
Yeah,
primary, secondary. How many you used, and did, you know, were you detecting any significant chocolate flavors coming
yeah.
through?
Yeah, I you know,
but, you know, getting everybody's opinion on it.
Yeah, and so today, rather than go cruise around the Facebooks that I usually do before the show, I spent probably a couple hours just Googling cocoa nibs in beer, cocoa nibs in wine, cocoa nibs in this and that and the other, roasting cocoa nibs. Here's the rundown, folks. To roast or not to roast? That's the question. So here's what I found out. 350 degrees for 30 minutes, 300 degrees for 12 to 15 minutes, or you can do 200 degrees for 15 minutes, 170 degrees for 10 minutes, 150 degrees for 5 minutes. Soak them in rum or vodka for 72 hours or up to 3 to 4 weeks. Plus, you can make a tincture with 2 ounces of cocoa nibs and 6 ounces of vodka for 4 days. Strain, then freeze, then strain again. So,
do whatever you want to do.
There just doesn't seem to be a standard, you know, out there for roasting cocoa nibs or what to do with them. And I didn't spend a great deal of time looking when I, you know, was putting them, when I was using them in my braggot. And, in my stout that I made for my wife. And, you know, the first couple of that came to was something like 200 degrees for like 15 minutes. That's kind of what I did. And I guarantee you, after about 10, 15 minutes, I mean, the house smelled like one big Hershey bar. Now, you could also do them. I did a small amount. Now, the thing about roasting them is you've got to be very careful because they will burn easy. You're just looking for a little color. You're looking for a little color change. They're going to get a little bit darker. But the thing about roasting is you got to keep moving them around. If you're going to do them in the oven, let them sit in there for 5 or 6 minutes. Take them out, stir them around, put them back in again. Keep moving them around. You got to keep turning them. The ones I did in a frying pan, you can do it on a non-stick. Don't do it in a cast iron, but do it in a non-stick frying pan. But you got to keep the pan moving over a medium heat. And again, you're just, you know, you're what I noticed is the color change. They get a little bit darker, and it starts smelling like chocolate. I mean, there's no mistaking. Chris, you came up with, another method using the vodka thing. And last we discussed, that's, you were going to do that, right?
Well, yeah. See, I didn't want to jump in and try to do this on my own. So I went the route of the Northern Brewer chocolate milk stout kit. And in the comments on that, I noticed that people who followed the directions exactly with the chocolate said that they weren't getting a lot of chocolate. It was almost unnoticeable. And then I read where most people were saying that you need to go ahead and put your 4 ounces of cocoa nibs in vodka. Just enough vodka to cover them when you start your primary. And by the time you get ready for your secondary, you just dump the whole thing in secondary and rack onto it. And the people who did that said that they were getting a lot more chocolate coming through. And some people even went so far as to add an extra couple of ounces for even a much stronger chocolate. So I knew by reading that that something had to be done to the nibs to maximize the flavor. Now I'm not trying to create a chocolate drink. I just want to, but I want a little bit more than a hint. You know me, right. I don't like to have to search for flavors. I like for most flavors to be prominent, at least enough so that you don't have to sit there and wonder, is that what I'm tasting? So, that's why I called you to see what you did to yours, because I know that some people roast the nibs and some people soak them. So, I think what I'm going to do for this first batch is I'm going to soak them in the vodka and try it, because this first batch is going to be simply a stout. There's not going to be any honey in it. And that'll give me an idea of how much chocolate's coming through. If it's enough, I'm going to stick with it when I do the braggot.
Yeah,
so that's what I arrived at. And I think sometime in the future, I probably will try toasting them. But see, my previous experience with using chocolate has been Dutch processed cocoa, which was a powder. It was not nibs. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact that you can get some really good chocolate flavor from that, and it's not harsh because it's been Dutch processed. So this is a new thing for me. This whole braggot thing in general is new, and so I think I'm just going to stick with the instructions and the general recommendations that everybody seems to be doing for the first go. And you know, I mean, when we started this program, we gave out the advice for new mead makers, you know, find a good recipe that's proven and don't change it. So I think I should take my own advice on this and do it by the recipe the first time and then make changes afterwards.
Ryan, Jeff, have you two, have you had an opportunity to use the cocoa nibs at all? And if you did, how did you treat them?
Well, I took some cocoa nibs and I put them in a mason jar and I filled it up with high proof clear alcohol and I let it sit for about 6 months or so. And then I strained it through a coffee filter and I use it as a chocolate extract in baking. And that's about my extent of my now of use of cocoa nibs.
Okay. And you got, what's the chocolate flavor that you got out of it? Was it pretty prominent? I mean, did it work?
You know, the yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, my wife was, we were looking for something to give a little more, something a little special when you're making a chocolate cake or a chocolate cookie or something that would just be that little something that you might not be able to put your finger on, but would make it pop a little more. And that definitely did it. I, you know, the cocoa nibs don't have the ones that I use. They have, really no sugar in them. So, I mean, if you wanted it, what we're used to as a chocolatey flavor, I think you'd have to, mix in some butter and some sugar, you know, to get, you know, the chocolate taste that we're used to out of it. I'm personally a dark chocolate guy. I mean, I like, you know, that 70, 80, 90%, you know, cocoa when I get a nice good dark chocolate bar. But I mean, even this is, you know, it'd be more along the lines of like if you were just to pop a few in your mouth, probably like an unsweetened, you know, baker's, you know, cocoa.
Yeah, no, don't, you know, it's the same thing like hops. You don't want to do a mouthful of cocoa nibs. They're not going to taste good, I guarantee it. I've already been there and done that. So, well, it's, you know, it's interesting the way you're using it in baking. Have you ever given any thought to thrown it in a mead or a beer, or have you come to that, you know, to that yet?
I've been real hesitant to do that. I've had some, now my experience has probably been tainted, but I've had it was some sort of a raspberry chocolate, you know, raspberry chocolate wine. I'm using air quotes as I say that, you know, dessert wine. And it was, just, you know, I mean, extremely strong, extremely sweet, extremely, you know, yeah, extreme. And so now I know that, you know, Chris, as you pointed out, I mean, you, in the beginning, you can use cocoa powder just purely as a source of tannin, you know, or something like that, you know, not even get any chocolate flavor out of it. But, it has not been a path that, that I've gone down yet. But you know, at some point I very well might.
Yeah.
You're not going to like my meads. I can tell you that. Everything I do is extreme. I go overboard. It's a habit that I have, and I think it has a lot to do with my ability to taste. I think I've said before, I have like the worst seasonal allergies in the world, except my season runs 365 days a year. So,
and Chris, I'm sure I'll enjoy some of your stuff. This raspberry chocolate wine I tasted was basically like if you took that, you know, a raspberry sundae topping, you know, their sweet, gooey type stuff. And you had that plus some chocolate syrup, and you put those two things in a bottle and you know, called it wine.
Oh, wow.
I would do that.
Wow.
I would do that.
No, Jeff,
that's why I drink dark roast coffee, you know, because I generally have to have fairly intense flavors in order to really perceive them well, whereas other people may not need something that intense. But since I make things to please myself, then that's how most of my stuff turns out. So you'll hardly ever, very seldom will you ever see me put a hint of something in anything.
Jeff, have you had any opportunity to work with Cocoa Nibs at all?
You know, I've not. They're on my list. They're just not terribly high up on it. I'm kind of in Ryan's camp where if I'm gonna have some chocolate, it's gonna be a dark chocolate, and
yeah.
It's just not one of my favorite things. Moreover, it's not one of my wife's favorite things, so it's not something I can use to bribe her with. So, you know, realistically, it's just one of those things I've meant to be tried, but haven't gotten around to. I probably will at some point. I just haven't yet.
Well, I'm kind of with Ryan, too, on the dark chocolate. In fact, and that was another thing that my cardiologist told me, eat dark chocolate. Oh, not that we eat a lot of it here, but I'm not a candy eater, never have been. So when it comes to, you know, candy bars, chocolate bars, that kind of thing, I prefer the darker chocolates because they're not as sweet as the milk chocolates are. And I just like that rough kind of a flavor. And that's kind of what you get. Now you can't mistake these for, you know, for anything even remotely close to a candy bar. I mean, that's not what these Cocoa Nibs are. They're going to give you that roasty chocolate flavor. You know,
and see, for me, that's where the milk stout comes in. To smooth that out. See, I like bold flavors, but I like them to be smooth. I don't want them to be harsh. So I choose a very dark roast coffee that's and brew it very strong, but then I add heavy cream to it to make it smooth.
Yeah.
And so even though, you know, something can be bold without being harsh. And that's what I'm
after. So. Yeah, and that's what you, I mean, you know, And I think because of that, you're probably going to go the lactose route to get some extra sugar in there without it fermenting away and
The lactose is going to be the milk part of the stout, basically. Yeah. But I'm going to be getting, if I do this, to my understanding, I'm going to be getting probably some chocolate from the specialty grains, probably as much as I will from the cocoa nibs, if not more, and probably going to get some coffee flavors from it. And, like I said, I've spent this week all my spare time trying to educate myself on how these different grains and things affect, adding wheat and things for head retention or for extra body or whatever.
Yeah.
And trying to learn a little bit of what I'm doing so I'm not just going at it blindly. But it's really difficult to get into something like that when you don't have a great interest in it, which is why this whole thing with this little apple cider project, that's how it came along when my mind started wandering. So yeah. I'll tell you about that a little bit later.
I wasn't all that excited about the cocoa thing, the chocolate thing. I'm not interested in making anything that's chocolate flavored. I don't want a chocolate flavored mead. There's this stuff they call adult chocolate milk in a liquor store, and we came home with a bottle of that one day, and that's the most foulest tasting stuff on the planet. It's just no good. I'm sorry. You just, alcohol and chocolate just don't, if it's a glass of wine with a piece of dark chocolate, that's one thing, but,
I don't know. That mead that Sergio sent us, the chocolate vanilla, that was, I think if I remember correctly, that was my favorite one of the whole batch he sent.
Yeah.
So I really did like that. But there again, I would have probably doubled, if not tripled, the chocolate in it.
Yeah. Well, the only reason why I'm working with the cocoa nibs is, this is for my wife's stout that I'm working on, this coffee stout. And I threw in some extra cocoa nibs, some extra vanilla beans. I put an extra pound of, I put a pound of lactose in it. And I brought the ABV up a little bit with some brown sugar. And I tasted it the other day, and it's got a good flavor. In fact, we put it in the keg this afternoon. So it's kegged up. It's not quite ready to drink yet. It's just I'm going to let it sit in the refrigerator for about a month before we put it through the tap. But that's the only reason why I was using it. Obviously my braggot is doesn't have anything to do with chocolate at all. So I really wasn't concerned about it. But I did want to, come up with something, that my wife enjoyed drinking, and she likes these chocolate coffee stout porters and whatnot. And so that was my concern. And, like I said,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, when I went out looking for, now that I got these, I got 2 pounds. I ordered 2 pounds of cocoa nibs. And so now what do I do with them? Okay. And then you roast them what? So I went out and searched on Google and like I said, here's my list: 350 degrees for 30 minutes, 300 degrees for 12 minutes, 170 degrees for 10, so on and so forth. So what do you do? So I just took someplace in the middle. I think it was like 200 degrees. For about 15 minutes, and it seemed to work. So,
well, judging from that mead that Sergio sent with the chocolate vanilla, that was he went very, from what I could tell from my taste, it was very light on the chocolate, but it added something to the mead without, you know, getting all caught up in the chocolate flavor. So I'm thinking that chocolate may be a good, a little adjunct to help emphasize other things, you know. So if you needed a little additional body or mouthfeel or tannins or whatever, you could treat it the same way that we've talked about before with vanilla beans or bananas or whatever. You know, you can take a half of a ripe banana in a 5-gallon batch of mead, and you can increase the body and mouthfeel without ever knowing there's a banana in it.
Yeah.
And it's probably those complex saccharides and things that are in there that are doing it. But I think there's probably some possibilities there to help modify something without actually adding chocolate flavor.
Yeah. Well, I, that was just a basic. Other people out there that I found that are, you know, just dumping them right in at the end, the last 5 minutes of the boil too. So, you know, and then there's another group of people out there that don't do anything to them, but just put them in the secondary and let them float around. So, you know, I guess it runs the gamut. I mean, you know, do whatever works for you, you know. But I
would say the operant question I have here with regards to like how you're handling that is it similar to things like dark grains or to the coffee we visited in that coffee experiment, where it would seem to me the takeaway I've gotten from both of those is that, you know, the higher heat you process those or the longer you process those on high heat, the more bitterness you get out of that as opposed to just a flavor. Whereas we saw like cold brewing the coffee got more coffee flavor and less bitterness. I think Ryan had the same observation with some of his grains too, that like cold steeping them, if you will, got a lot of that flavor out without the bitterness involved. So I wonder if that's part of the idea behind some of these different approaches.
You know, I don't know, because I did do some reading where somebody had taken and roasted their cocoa nibs and then chewed on a couple of them, and he said they tasted sweet. He could detect a level of sweetness. So I can tell you that the ones that I chewed on weren't sweet. Now, you know, whether they were supposed to be or not, I couldn't tell you. But here again, I'm not looking for a sweet candy bar type chocolate effect. I'm looking for that, you know, what baker's chocolate contributes to a chocolate cake. I'm looking for chocolate, not, you know, I'm looking for that cocoa taste, that cocoa bean taste, not a candy bar taste. So, I think that's what I got, when I tasted that stout today before we racked it. That's what I'm tasting. I'm tasting a kind of a dark chocolate flavor, but it's not sweet at all. I mean, there's very, 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 very little, if any, sweetness to it at all. So it's not like eating a chocolate bar. So, but it certainly runs the gamut. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to reserve judgment entirely until I finish this batch, and then I'll have a much better idea of where I'm going with it. And that's why I want to get some bottles out to you guys, too, when it's finished, because I'm going to need input from different palates to see, you know, where it really stands, because I'm not the most sensitive taster in the world, and especially when it comes to more subtle things like that. So, and I'm also not well versed in the craft beer industry either. So,
I did take 4 ounces of cocoa nibs. And I didn't roast them, didn't do anything to them. I put them in a 1-pint mason jar. Just covered it. That's the recommendation. Just cover. You don't want to fill the mason jar up. Just cover the cocoa nibs with vodka, And I littered it up and I'll check it in a couple of days and see where we're at with it. I kind of like that idea. Ryan's had some pretty good luck. I don't know about letting it sit for 6 months, but did you do anything to you just dumped them in the jar, right, Ryan? You didn't cook them down or roast them or do anything to them, right?
No. I bought raw cocoa nibs, and then I put them in the jar and then every so often I, open up the pantry and shake the jar just to keep everything moving around. That was it.
Okay. Michael Fairbrother was with us last week, and what a pleasure it was to have him on the show. A lot of useful information I came away with that. But after the show was over with, I was sitting here, during the show when he was talking, we got into a pretty good discussion about making braggots. And if you recall, a couple shows ago, we had talked about we're going to treat this braggot thing that we were doing. Are we going to treat it like a mead, or are we going to treat it like a beer? Because there's a couple of different schools of thought out there on management, and I think a good number of us, if not all of us, decided, it's a mead style, so I'm going to treat it like a mead. That's what I did. So I stirred the crap out of it for the first 4 days. And then to hear Michael Fairbrother say, no, don't stir it. So I was plenty worried, dude. How did you guys, what were you guys, are you worried about it? Did you stir? Where are you at with it? What do you think?
Well,
I fully intended to. I was going to stir it just like a mead, but I got busy with work and everything and actually ended up neglecting it. And I guess it turned out to be a good thing.
Yeah. Ryan,
I was a little concerned. I'll admit that. At the same time, we have my braggot is 50% honey, and I'm using, some adjuncts. I'm using toasted coconut. I'm using vanilla bean. I caramelized that honey. I didn't stir it up. I didn't, aerate the hell out of it. I wasn't really breaking the surface all that much as just making sure that the yeast was moving around. So the way I look at it is, even if there was some very slight oxidation of the malt that I was using, and again, I was using chocolate malt and roasted barley and dark malt extract, that the adjuncts and all of the bold flavors that are in there from the coconut, the vanilla, and the caramelized honey are going to cover a little bit of that oxidation, and if anything, that oxidation might actually, if it hits the form of a sherry-like flavor, might actually enhance the braggot in the finished product. And again, I plan on aging this out for quite a while, and so we'll see how that age generally helps at least meads. Now, I'm also very good at circular reasoning, so all of this might just be put me at peace of mind.
Yeah, sounds good, huh?
Yeah. Well, you can follow my rule. If I ever have something that starts to oxidize, I just throw in some dried cherries.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is. If it starts to oxidize, throw in some cherries and it tastes like you meant to do it.
There you go. Well, I was thinking with this, the old brewer's, you know, kind of half joke is, if you don't like the way it turned out, you just dry hop it and cover it with hop flavor. And so, you know, with this being a beer style, I get that's my backup. If before we lose a 5-gallon batch, let's just hop the hell out of it and use that.
Yeah, that's funny. Gosh, I wish Aaron was here. He'd go along with that too, I bet. He likes that hopped up stuff. Jeff, what was your take on that whole thing Michael was talking about, the stirring, not stirring thing? What's your...
this is my second time through doing a Braggot, and I'm a little bit concerned, and I'm probably going to revisit it in future batches, but realistically, compared to a regular mead, I didn't stir it as much, mainly because I found, like, getting the drill in there and getting it going, the graininess of it, it really whipped up a frothy head, or I don't know about a head, but like krausen, yeah. I forget the term for that, and really discouraged me from doing too much of that. So I think that might have been a saving grace for me. It made it, my own laziness might have helped me out there a little bit in that regard, or just not wanting to deal with that mess. So I might not do that at all in the future. I might still do the same thing. That's probably something I need to test a little bit. See if it makes a difference.
I'm still under the impression that things need to be moved around though. And especially starting with that much gravity and that much honey, and those yeast are not, if you're using a beer yeast, they're not going to be optimized to the honey anyway. So they're going to need all the help they can get. And I think that there's a general way of moving things around without introducing oxygen. Just to keep things moving and try to get the best attenuation you can from it.
With the beer that I did, with the two beers that I've done so far, my half inch drill, it's a battery deal, it's a variable speed, and I put my stirrer on, and with the beer, I just turn it enough. I don't even make a whirlpool. I just spin it enough just to agitate it a little bit to get the yeast moving. And then I stop. I mean, we're talking, maybe 10 seconds of a gentle stir. And I try not to disturb the surface at all with it. So, because I do believe in keeping the yeast suspended and all that good stuff. So, but on my meads, I'll stir the crap out of it. Get a good head of CO2 working out of that thing. The Braggot thing, like we discussed on that one show a couple of weeks ago, as far as I was concerned, it's a style of mead. So I'm going to treat it just like a mead. And I fed it. I don't have my book in front of me. I need to start putting a book on a desk here, but I think it was Fermaid K is, I think I would. What did I tell you, Chris? I used DAP once in the beginning,
Fermaid K.
Yeah, Fermaid K is what I used. Yeah, I used Fermaid K, and I only used DAP in the beginning, and then no DAP number 2, 3, and 4. And it right now it tastes fine. It's got this is that bourbon barrel Braggot that we're doing here, and I use 16 ounces, actually a little bit more than 16 ounces of bourbon, because I had soaked the oak cubes in about 2 ounces of bourbon, and I dumped it all in. So we're probably looking at maybe 16 and a half, 17, 18 ounces, somewhere in there. When it all comes to it, but it's got a really nice bourbon flavor right now. Not so much the oak flavor yet. That's still young yet, so I'm waiting for that to come around. and it's not hot. It's not alcoholic hot, which is a good thing. It was fermented at 66 degrees. But like Ryan, I'm going to let the thing sit. I'm not in any big hurry. So I intend on giving it at least maybe 4 months, at least that.
Well, you know, JD, we promised our listeners from day one that we would only put out either information that was proven that we knew worked, or we would let them know that we're trying it out and we'll throw the honey out for you, as we said early on. And we may end up throwing some out in this go around, but this style, this Braggot deal, if you could go back 150 or 200 years in Great Britain or Ireland or Scotland, you would find Braggots everywhere, even up to the early 1900s. But this has been pretty much out of the brewer's language for a very, very long time, and it's almost like trying to rediscover it, reinventing it. And so unless there are some very, very old breweries left over in Europe that never stopped making it in the first place, we're pretty much left to reinvent it. So yeah. I kind of look at it that way. I don't really feel like I've got any set rules that I've got to follow. I've just got to create something that is representative of mead and of the beer style, and it works well together, and I like it. So that's really the only rules I'm trying to follow here.
Are you pounding on my leather?
I'm drawing your pattern, actually.
I can hear the hammer.
No, I was drawing your pattern. You probably heard the eraser.
I heard something banging in the background.
No, there's no banging here.
Oh. Well, all right. So, but you're onto something else there you're not in Mississippi. Where are you? Well, I guess you are. Let's call it Corinth, Mississippi. Yeah, you got something else going on down there.
I'm not in Corinth. I'm from Corinth. I'm not in Corinth.
Ah, okay. Let's just call it Mississippi. You got something else going on down there in the cider world, don't you?
I do. I was reading about all these different malts and beer additions, and my mind started to wander, and I started thinking about making a hard cider. And the discussion we had about the apples that we have available to us, and that we don't have the greatest variety. And so I started thinking, how can I make up for some of the things that are lacking in the apples that we have? And that's primarily bitter apples, for one. And it seems like that a lot of the cider that I've tried to make turns out really, really thin-bodied. And I mean, a cider should be thin. A cider should be light, but it shouldn't be heavy. But I don't want it to be so watery. So
that's my trouble too. Yeah.
And I was thinking, how can I fix this? And some of the stuff I was reading about the beer, adding body and of course then hops or bittering and everything. I didn't want to make a beer cider mix. I didn't want anything like that. I wanted to make a pure cider, but just use just enough to augment it. So I was thinking, okay, I can make up for a lack of bitter apples with some small additions of hops, and I can maybe use something like some Crystal 120 or something to add a little bit more body to it, but keep the amounts very, very low, very small. Do like maybe a 2 or 3 quart steep or a boil with these, and then the rest is apple juice, and I've made up the difference. And so, you know, the more I thought about it, and I ran it through the calculator, and everything worked out perfect. And the addition of using the crystal malt solved the problem of having to use sugar, because I was getting enough jump in gravity from that it solved the whole problem. And I'm thinking, okay, I already started writing my speech for the American Homebrewers Association Hall of Fame induction, you know.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of myself. I've come up with something just perfect here. Then this is going to work. So I get online to start searching around to see what hops and things might go good with apple flavor. And lo and behold, I find out that I haven't invented anything. People have been doing this for years. In fact, the experimental recipe idea that I wrote down was exactly the one that everybody's been doing for at least 6 or 7 years.
Oh, geez.
And there's this huge thread on Homebrew Talk started by a guy named Brandon O. And it's called a Groff, and it came from a Stephen King novel. It was a fictional drink that Stephen King wrote about in this book, The Dark Tower, and he called it a Groff. And it was a cider that had a small little bit of malt and hops in it to make it taste like a good cider. And so, you know, my excitement was dashed a little bit, but the good thing is everybody that did it absolutely loved the results. So I immediately ordered all the ingredients to do it. And, you know, the downside is I don't get my homebrewer's award, but the upside is everybody's already done it and worked out the kinks, so it'll be good. Yeah. So I wanted to share that. No, really, I really wanted to share that because that may be, and I haven't made it yet. It's going in the fermenter tomorrow, actually.
But that
may be a perfect answer to all the problems that we have here in America with making a good cider.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because... you know, I had my second bottle of cider here just, you know, last week. And it's an English cider. I love the English ciders because they're just so right on. You know, and I've tried all the Angry Orchards and everything. And I just, it's more like soda pop for me, and I just don't care for them. But these English ciders, they're on to something. I mean, that's like the real deal.
Yeah.
So
anyway,
you know,
this is anyone who wants to make this, just go Google Groff. It's G-R-A-F or G-R-A-F-F recipe, and it's started by Brandon O on Homebrew Talk, and real simple, easy to follow. It's only like, I think it's only like three ingredients that go in, three or four.
So you're just using store-bought apple juice?
Yep. Just like, now, the one thing that I did take away from it is if you can find apple juice that has no vitamin C added, you'll be able to drink it and enjoy it a lot faster. The vitamin C or ascorbic acid is going to add some tartness to it that takes a while to kind of mellow out and blend. I was lucky enough to find some store-bought apple juice that didn't have anything at all in it. The only downside is it's from concentrate, which I would rather not have had, but I'm going to be solving that problem pretty soon because I'm going to be working on my my cider press. So I'm gonna solve that problem. But this first batch is going in tomorrow, and it's like a pound of I think it's a pound of amber DME, a pound of light DME, a half a pound of crystal 120, and like a half an ounce of some sort of hops that are around 6% alpha acids. And so you boil this up in 3 quarts of water for 30 minutes, and then you sparge your crystal with another quart of water, boil it for 30 minutes, and so that creates about a gallon. And then you make it up to 5 or a little over 5 gallons with your apple juice, and he suggests using Nottingham to ferment it, or SO4.
Yeah.
I know that's sort of keeping in line with an English style cider. So
yeah,
I'm going to use Nottingham on this, and then you leave it in primary for about 2 weeks. You can secondary it for about 2 weeks, and then you bottle condition it with 3/4 cup of dextrose, and pretty straightforward. That's about it. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to it. I really thought I had come up with something great, but somebody beat me to it.
Well, we'll put the award back up on the shelf for another day then.
I'll come up with something else.
I'm sure you will. That does sound good. And I like the way I've done ciders. In fact, I've got one going right now. It's just, you know, regular old, I don't remember the brand, whatever the brand is. Store-bought cider, that clear apple juice, chemical-free and all that kind of good stuff. And I use Nottingham. I put like a pound of sugar in it, brown sugar, and I use Nottingham. And it goes pretty dry. I mean, there's hardly any sweetness in it. But, you know, like I say, it's good when it's done, but it's like really watery. It's just that thin, you know. It needs something else, and I really don't want to put a whole bunch of, you know, I don't want to drop cinnamon sticks and all this stuff, but I do kind of like that idea that Michael was talking about, Fairbrother on that last show, about a vanilla bean and cinnamon, and he said that's all he does to his, and he can't keep it in stock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's his number one selling mead. So, anyway, I'll report back on this when it's done. Hopefully, this will be ready by Christmas.
Hey, Chris, sorry if I missed it there. What kind of hops did you use again?
I'm using Fuggles.
Okay.
Now, the Fuggles are a little bit under 6%, but the guy, the original poster there, he did mentioned that if you're going to adjust the hop level, always adjust downward, because otherwise it's just going to be too much. It'll clash and be too bitter. So I think there was somewhere in the thread that he did mention he had had the best results with Fuggles.
Okay.
So a half an ounce of Fuggles for 30 minutes. You're only boiling it for 30 minutes. Anyway, so
sure.
A 30 minute steep and a 30 minute boil.
I think I've got it right here. You used a half a pound of crystal 60L.
He said you can use 60L if you have light colored store bought apple juice. He recommends 120L.
Yeah.
But if you have if you have fresh pressed, which is naturally darker, then you can use 60L.
And what is torrefied wheat?
It's basically just wheat that's been roasted, and that's only added to improve head retention. And you only add an ounce of it. So you put your crystal 120 and your 1 ounce of torrefied wheat in a grain bag, and you steep it at 155 for 30 minutes in 3 quarts of water. Then you sparge that with another quart. So now you've got a 1 gallon boil. You bring that to a boil. You mix in 1 pound of amber DME, 1 pound of light DME, and a 1/2 ounce of Fuggles. Boil that for 30 minutes and let it cool, put in your apple juice. I'm going to put in pectic enzyme in that. I don't think that's in the recipe, but I'm not working with apple juice without some pectic enzyme because it'll never clear.
Yeah.
Well, if you're dealing with the craft, you know, the craft beer world, the haze is cool. Haze is what's in.
Oh, haze? Well.
Oh, yeah. You'd be. I mean, I kind of live in one of the hotbeds of craft breweries, and you'd be hard pressed to go to a craft brewery, you know, and find a clear beer. Just about, you know, and I'm sure there's gonna be people who are, you know, writing in telling me I'm wrong, but most of them right now are using the a lot of the strains are low flocculation and leave a lot of that haze, you know, behind in the beer. Mm-hmm. So don't think of it as an imperfection. Think of it as trendy.
Yeah. Well, I always find an excuse for whatever goes wrong.
My impression of an English cider is that it's supposed to be a little bit hazy, a little bit cloudy anyway. It's just kind of that, what do I want to say? It's like a rustic style, like kind of like what Ryan said. It's a desirable trait. So I don't think that's mm-hmm. necessarily a problem anyway.
Well, you go back to... Go back to, I don't think they really cared about, you know, whether ciders were clear, whether beers were clear, you know, back in the turn of the century, 1800s, 1700s anyway. So, you know, unless they put it through an old pair of socks or something, but, I mean, honestly, I mean, who cares? You know, I mean, I don't think it alters the flavor that much. Cause I've had hazy beer at some of these craft places that we go to eat. I don't detect any flavor difference in the beer, you know. So
I think Brandon O, the guy who came up with this recipe, he actually made a point in the recipe there where he said that if you're not worried about haze, you don't even have to bother cooling that 1 gallon boil. Just go ahead and dump it right in your cold apple juice and it'll cool it right down. But it will cause it to be hazy because the heat will set the pectins in the apple juice. He said if you're worried about clarity, go ahead and cool that boil down. And it won't take long to cool a 1 gallon boil in a sink of ice water. So I'll probably bring it down to, you know, 100 degrees or so and then go ahead and put it in and put my pectic enzyme in. That's not going to hurt anything.
Well, you know what? I'm going to contact him. I'll see if I can contact him and get his permission, and we'll throw this recipe up on our website. I mean, it looks really good. I don't really see mm-hmm. anything wrong with it. And plenty of people are – I'm on the website right now at Homebrew Talk. And there's 100 how many threads are there?
It's like 100 and something pages of...
100, actually there's 309 pages, okay, of this one thread.
And here I'm thinking I came up with something new.
Well,
you can imagine my surprise when I
yeah, but here's the other thing too. I mean, you know, that I've discovered on some of these forums is, you know, somebody will put up a recipe. It's, you know, and they've tested it, they've done it numerous times, they've perfected it, and, you know, and it works. And then, you know, the next 100 pages after that are people who do the recipe but change this, change that, and then start asking questions. How come it didn't turn out this way, or I'm getting these off flavors here, or, you know. But certainly, I mean, if it's a proven recipe, if it works, don't change it unless you know what you're doing, or you're not afraid of the result if it doesn't turn out, you know, the way you expect it. I mean, it's not going to be the guy's fault that wrote the recipe to begin with. It'll be your own fault. So, but
I think I did a soapbox episode on that, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. Yeah, you did. And we're about due for another soapbox too, by God.
Oh, I got plenty of them. Yeah.
Ryan, you got an interesting way of creating wort. Now, is this something accidental, or how did this turn out here? Tell us about this thing.
Yeah, so I'll call this one a happy accident. And what happened is, I've mentioned in the past a couple of things. I've said that, and Jeff kind of teased it earlier, that, you know, one of the strategies that I like doing in extracting flavor from specialty grains is to cold steep them. So I've got a big, wide mouth, it's almost a 2-gallon glass jar. And I'll take a grain bag and I'll throw specialty grains in that and fill the jar up and let it steep. And then I usually let it steep for 24 hours and I'm left with this infused, water of the specialty grain. You know, you've done that with dark malts and you can pull out coffee notes or chocolate notes or toffee notes, whatever character exists in this specialty malt, as well as reducing the bitterness or astringency that would come when you would expose it to heat. I typically do this for 24 hours. Now, what I also do, and I've mentioned before, is kind of if we were each to pick kind of what is your mead specialty? What is your corner of mead that you guys like? You know, we might find that Chris likes his big, bold, sweet flavored, you know, higher gravity, you know, meads, and things like that, you know, and Jeff and, you know, I know JD, you might still be searching for yours and that kind of thing. For me, I like dry session strength meads. So they're, you know, 7% ish, you know, and dry and I can have a pint of it. You know, I can pour a beer glass worth of it and drink it the way I drink a beer or something. Mm-hmm. Well, when you ferment a mead, from what I've found, when I ferment a mead totally dry, that honey flavor and that honey aroma is pretty much gone. And you've got to wait, you know, a month, 6 months, whatever, for it to come back, for that honey aroma, that honey flavor to come back, you know, into the mead, which is pretty amazing on how honey does that. Well, here was the experiment that I tried. There is a malt out there called a honey malt. It's by a Canadian malting company, and I don't have their name in front of me. It's one of those, you know, if you were to just go Google honey malt or go to a homebrew shop and type in honey malt, you know, it'd pop up. It's nothing that's hard to find. But one of the flavor profiles in this is it can taste like honey. It can add a little bit of a honey flavor. So my experiment was, okay, I'm going to steep this honey malt, and then I'm going to add my honey to it, ferment it dry, and see if that honey malt lends a little bit of flavor to it that I can drink it a little faster and still have a little bit of honey flavor, or a little more honey flavor to it than you would get if you didn't have that. Now, you know, any of the brewers out there, you'll know that typically you've got to have a malt that has not been roasted completely and still has some active starches in it or enzymes in it. And you've got to, then that heat, you know, activates, you know, starts kicking in. And like if you're in an all grain brewer, you know, you need to get the heat just, you know, to the right temperature, and that activates the enzymes and they start converting the starches to sugars. And now you've got your mash. Well, like I said, when I steep these specialty grains for 24 hours, they really provide no fermentable sugars because there's no enzyme activation going on. So anyway, that's all the background. That's all the backstory. That's my little bit on that. So I, you know, last week did that. I got some honey malt, put it in a grain bag, threw it in my jug, filled it up with water and set it aside. You know, it had a top on it, and I've got kids, busy, life sets in, and I didn't let it steep for 24 hours. I let it steep for 7 days. And I came back and I go, oh man, I better look at this. And
like big oops.
Yeah, oops. I opened it up and I just get hit with this nutty honey aroma. So there is unlike, you know, now I haven't had any honeys, you know, maybe somebody, a honey expert could tell me a honey that does have some nuttiness to it, but this was like a nutty honey aroma, and it was great. And the color was beautiful, like a dark amber, and you know, and it looked great. And I said, you know, I'm curious as to what the gravity is on this, just to see what happened. And I checked it, and the gravity was 10.20, meaning that these enzymes had started converting starches to sugars. And then in our email chain, Jeff said, hey, you know, why don't you plug that into a brewer's calculator and see what you would have expected from it, you know, if you had heated it. And it was within 5 points of what the brewer calculator said you'd get if you heated it. So basically, you got full efficiency out of just steeping it for about a week. Which, you know, I mentioned also to you guys would be, you could essentially create a no heat beer or a no heat braggot by, now if you pitched your yeast and then if you were to dry hop it, you know, and you had essentially absolutely no heat involved. Now, I know what some of our listeners are thinking, and I'll just call it out and I'll say yes, of course. That, you know, the malt probably had something, dust or something on it, and unless you were to boil that liquid, you would not have a purely sanitary, you know, wort right. to start with. I'm just talking about technically what would be possible, not what is the best practice if you want to do it that way. Yeah. But, so anyway, just middle of my experiment, I took this honey malt wort, essentially, 1 gallon of it, added 1.5 pounds of wildflower honey, brought it up to about 1077, what did I have? It was a wine yeast. I want to say it was the 1122. Because again, I wasn't treating it like a beer, so I didn't have much beer yeast on hand. I was treating it more like I would a traditional mead. So, and it And it was, I hydrated the yeast and rehydrated the yeast, and then I pitched it. And I'm not exaggerating, you guys. It's within 15, 30 minutes, I was seeing bubbles. And,
holy cow.
And it took off like a rocket. Just this, the fermentation. And I'm excited to see what happens, you know, how dry it runs. My other variable will be, if any of that original 1020 was unfermentable sugars, if there had something had happened there. But then I'll report back as well and see if this at a very young age and dry still brings you some honey aroma and a little honey flavor from that malt.
I mean, how much grain to water ratio are we looking at? I mean, how much grain did you use and how much water did you use?
Well, here's where Chris and I, become kindred spirits. Is I to make 1 gallon of liquid, I used 1 pound of honey malt, which is a lot.
Yeah,
to make one pound of honey, that's not a whole lot, though, is it?
Well, if that
works out for you, if you're going to make a high gravity mead and use that, then you wouldn't have to worry about the sanitation issue. But for doing what you're doing, you always have the option of treating it like fresh juice and sulfiding it.
If
you're really that worried about it, you could brew it up and then sulfide it Problem solved.
No, that's a good point. You can always do that. Exactly. No, JD. When you're making beers, this honey malt would be considered a specialty grain. And so, you know, 1 pound of specialty grain in a 1 gallon batch would be, off the charts.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, because I've seen some recipes where a 5 gallon batch only had 1 pound of specialty grains.
Or a quarter pound.
The kits that I get, it's like half a pound of this and a quarter pound of that specialty grains in the kits that I do. So, interesting. When do you suspect this little project is going to be completed, do you think?
I'm going to check it. I'm almost treating it like a 1 month kind of mead. I want to do a test like that. So in the next couple of weeks,
did you taste it? Did you taste the wort before you pitched, or?
I tasted it just a little bit. I mean, I use like an eye drop. I have my refractometer. You only use basically an eyedropper just to put, three drops on the lens. And, I tasted just a couple of drops on the tip of my tongue. And it did have we're talking about a grain here. So it did have kind of a grainy taste a little bit. But it was, a sweet grain, on there. So it'll be interesting. Like I said, my plan is to rack it, here in a second. I am going to do a rack it over, rack it, put it in, see how well it clears on its own and taste it along the way and see how it would be drinkable in the same way that a lot of session or hydromels, can be drinkable in a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
Isn't there some sort of iodine test or something you can do to check and see how much conversion you had?
Yes, I think there is. It's I've never looked into how it's done, but I've seen other homebrewers do it when they talk about measuring the efficiency of their setup. You inoculate with some iodine, and then you get a measure based on that of like how much was converted via enzyme or something like that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I think you take a few drops of your wort and you put it on a like a white background plate or something, and you put a couple of drops of iodine tincture there, and if it remains red, you don't have much conversion, but if it turns black, then you have fermentable sugars present. That's how I understand it. I'll have to look into it.
Huh. Interesting. Well, I hope it works out. Keep tabs on it for us and let us know how it turns out and everything.
And I will clarify that even though Jeff originally would have called this a methaglen, Michael Fairbrother would classify it as a braggot. I'm sorry. Only about 500 more times on that joke, Jeff. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, and here we are blurring the lines between styles, and I see his point that it is a grain, and even if you're not getting fermentables from the grain, well, yeah, no, we're... Okay.
Yeah, but Jeff, you said something. One of your comebacks on the email, one of your replies, and I took note of it mentally. There's a word in there that really stands out to this whole thing that we do, fringe.
Yep.
I mean, this is such a boundaryless thing we're doing. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we're only limited to that by what is available out there to consume. I mean, for crying out loud, I've seen people make beers with freaking chocolate cakes and carrots and you name it.
Yeah.
I mean,
I've had mead that was flavored with the fruit of the cashew tree. most of the Western world, it forgets even exists and like discards as junk. We live in a world that is incredibly connected and incredibly, like, if I wanted to make a mead like that, I'm pretty sure with a little bit of effort, I could run down a source in South America or Africa and get myself a few bushels of cashew apples to make a mead with. It would take time, it would take money, but it's technically possible. And that's the funny thing about mead is that, you know, even less extreme stuff, than those examples, we're still figuring stuff out, and it's the outer fringes of the mead world have not been explored the same way that we've had the time to explore craft beer or wine, and that's what makes this an exciting hobby, is that we're figuring stuff out as we go.
And now we just have to start keeping an eye out for the observers. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, look up the TV series Fringe, and you'll.
Yep, I love that show.
You remember the Observers?
Yeah, I love that show, dude. Oh yeah,
and you know, Jeff, to your point of and joking about to call it, there's a brewery not far from me that is a gluten-free brewery. And they say, we make gluten-free beer. Well, they use sorghum instead of, malt. And I think, so you say to yourself, well, they call it a beer, but I mean, is it really a beer? It's sorghum. It's not barley.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it at all. I'm just, when I joke and we're all friends here, so that's why I rib them once in a while on that, and I'm sure
when we were on the ranch, okay, when we were fattening up the last few months, actually probably maybe about the last few months, fattening up the steers, they went on what we called a sweet feed, and it was grained corn and oats and whatnot, and it was sweetened with sorghum. And you know, my trips into the grain bin would always include a handful, throw in my own mouth and chew on it. You know.
Yep.
I mean,
if you've ever worked on a farm or a ranch and you haven't had a mouthful of sweet feed,
yeah,
then you weren't working very hard.
That's it. And you just put it in there and chew on it while I go out there and feed the cows and do the chores, chewing on some chaw.
And if you want to see something really funny, wait until you have a steer that has a bad stomach and he eats sweet feed and it ferments and gets him drunk. If you've never seen a drunk steer, you haven't lived.
Yep. You got to be careful.
Any comedy act. Yeah, it's better than any comedy act you could ever go see.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, I didn't measure by pounds. It was a level in a bucket that I used. And, you had to be careful. You just couldn't throw a crap load of sweet feed out there for, you know, you had to be careful how much you're feeding them. But, that's what we used at the end to, put a nice layer of back fat and everything on the beef when we, just before we killed. So, sorghum. Why not use sorghum?
Well, and actually, an interesting statistic I heard over this weekend, sorghum is actually the number one source of fermentable sugars in alcohol products worldwide. A lot of communities in Africa will do essentially like a cottage alcohol production where, you know, a few people in the towns or the villages will produce for everybody in the village. A lot of Chinese villages have a drink called baijiu that is mainly made with sorghum, as I understand it. There's just a lot of sorghum grows pretty diversely. It's a pretty hardy plant, and it has a pretty good amount of sugar to it. So why not? It's not something you think about, but it is the most commonly used fermented sugar on the planet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And despite all that, I have still not been able to find a way to use it in a mead and have a good product. And I know there's a way to do it. There's got to be some way, but I have failed in all my attempts so far. So
I think there's a recipe for it on Denard Brewing.
For sorghum-based mead?
I think there is a. I
can't
think,
be using pure sorghum. He's got to be mixing it with other stuff. I'm sure.
I think it's a honey sorghum syrup recipe.
Yeah,
I think he referred to it as a sorghum.
Yeah, there you go.
Something like that. Yeah.
The sorghum syrup. I mean, that's going to be it's not going to taste like molasses, but it's going to be kind of like a molasses. It's pretty, pretty rich stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorghum syrup mead.
I mean, if he's buying sorghum syrup from like a feed store or something like that, where it's, you know, more commonly, you know, where you can get it most commonly, it's really thick and.
And he's,
you know, I remember when Bray was actually formulating that recipe over on the Got Mead forums, and he asked people's opinion on it. And I had told him on that thread, I commented and said that I had not had good luck with it. And I told him how much I had used. And I think what he came up with was the idea that it was good in smaller amounts.
Yeah, his recipe calls for 10 ounces of sorghum syrup per 2.5 pounds of honey.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he figured out that the secret to it was to dial back the sorghum quite a bit and keep the amount below, I believe he, at that time, I think he might have said like 7% or something of the fermentables. But he may have altered that since then. I don't know.
Well,
but yeah, if you keep keep the amount low and you can probably do it.
Well, I mean, you know, here we are talking about, you know, using sorghum in a mead. So, I mean, that fringe stuff is out there, the fringe. What was that old man's name? That was a father and son, that old man, that old scientist. God, I love that show. That's such a great show.
Walter.
Anyway, Walter, yeah.
Walter.
Yeah. Old Walter.
Yeah, and he never could get the other girl's name.
Yeah.
Right. He called her something different every time.
You
need to go back. If you've never seen that, go on Netflix or somewhere and look up Fringe and watch. You'll watch the whole entire every season of it in order.
It's a lot of fun.
I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but if you do decide to watch it, make sure you pay attention and don't skip any episodes, because when you get toward the end, the stuff that happened way back at the beginning is very important.
Yep. Yeah, that was a good show. I love that show.
Yeah.
Anybody besides our Braggot projects, anybody got anything on a bucket list or a hopper list? Or?
Now that I heard Ryan's description of what he likes, and I already know what Jeff likes, and I think Aaron may be right in there with him. So I guess I'm going to have to try and create a session mead that they can enjoy. So I'm thinking about taking my base recipe for my Sourwood Traditional and working it into a session strength.
Yeah.
You know, we were chatting after the show last week, and I've got to get some fermenter space open. So that's the only reason I haven't kicked this one off yet. But I'm going to start a piment, and it's going to be a blend of red Zinfandel juice, Pinot Noir juice, and then mesquite honey. And I'm going to do that, and then I'm probably going to, you know, after it ferments all the way down, I'm going to let it sit on some oak and do that. But that's the next one that I've got going here. And part of the reason, you know, is I think I told you guys that when I got into the hobby and you know, cider, beer, mead, you know, wine, anything else, and my wife, you know, kind of let me embrace it, was I said, honey, this is going to reduce the amount of beer and wine that we buy at the liquor store. And to date, it has not.
Yep. I was going to say, all you people out there listening to the Mead House here, I hope you guys are taking notes on how to get stuff past your wife.
And for all the ladies listening, I'm sorry, but we don't have any advice for you.
And so
I wish we did.
I'm going to make some stuff that is a lot closer to these stuff that we usually buy, and see if we can find a suitable clone, so to speak.
I like the idea of using grape juice. That's my next thing. I love a good wine. I like good red wines. I like a variety. My preferences is the drier side of the wines. I mean, I like Zinfandels. I like Cabernets. I like Merlots. And I like good, deep red, heavily oaked red blends, table wines, too. But that would be my next, my next deal with the meads. I think I found my preference in meads, and I think it's going to be the Braggot thing. But I'm willing to give this Ryan, this grape juice thing, a whirl too. That just, the whole thing sounds good to me. Jeff, you got anything in the hopper at all, or still working on stuff?
I've got all kinds of stuff in primary at the moment. I think I've got like 8 or 9 gallons of random stuff in 1 gallon fermenters or little buckets. I took Chris at his suggestion over the weekend and went out to Home Depot and got a couple more little 2 gallon food grade buckets to start making some stuff because I've still got fruit in the freezer from like late spring and into summer that meant to go make metheglins with and never really got around to because it was so hot and I've been kind of like getting sidetracked with that that refrigerator project. Yeah. So you know, and on top of that, I've also got like sizers and ciders and big batches. So I'm running at a fair clip with all my fermenters these days after a pretty slow summer.
I have, I was thinking about that blueberry cider thing, Chris. And, so I went out, I bought a couple of gallons of apple juice and I had 1 pound of blueberries in the freezer and I bought another 3 pound bag. I just started putting stuff in a bucket, and I put the blueberries in, mashed them all up, threw some pectic enzyme in, dumped the apple juice in, put 1 can of apple juice concentrate in on top of that. I added enough honey, and I can't get up from my desk here to go get my book, but I think I come up to 120 on the hydrometer. After I put the honey in, wildflower, because I just picked up another 60-pound bucket of honey. What yeast did I use? A 71B. I just threw some 71B in it. You know, with some GoFirm and everything. And so it's you know, probably maybe a 2.5 gallon, not quite a 3 gallon. Deal.
Don't do the lees aging part with that 71B, and you're probably going to end up, if you started at 120, you're probably going to want to sweeten that up a little bit once it's finished.
We'll see where it winds up. If I need to, you know, maybe throw some more honey into it. You know what I might even do is add some apple concentrate.
You may want to stay away from that because you've already added the apple concentrate. And see, this is the problem, like with the Graf. You've got all this vitamin C that's added in the apple juice and in the concentrate.
Yeah.
So, and then you're going to get some astringency and you're going to get some sharpness from the blueberries as well. But that works well in that particular mead because if you finish in a gravity of like 10, 20 something, it's almost perfect to balance with that sharpness that comes in there. So
yeah, I think we're looking at like something. You do the math; it was something like 10-16 or something like that is where I kind of figured it might wind up. If it hits there,
you'll probably need to sweeten that up a little bit.
You're
going to need it probably in the 10, 20 something range. I think I put in the recipes start at 11:30, which with D47, that would put you down around, you know, 10:22 or something like that.
Yeah.
That's usually about where they end up, and they're pretty good there. And they actually don't come across as being sweet because of all the tartness that's in there with it. So,
yeah.
You know, I've got that going, and I've got these beers that are about to start to try to create another braggot. And I've got, an update. The chocolate orange finally cleared.
Yeah.
It no longer looks like Guatemalan goat vomit, but it's still got this color to it. It's almost a mahogany color, and it's one of the weirdest looking meads. If you look at it in the light, it has almost a almost a neon look to it. So It's pretty weird looking stuff, but my gosh, is it good.
Wow. And you're going to call it what? Goat vomit?
I don't know yet. I don't know what we're going to call
vomit
it yet.
Chocolate.
Well, it's kind of a vitamin Swill. T orange. I think we.
That's funny.
So we'll see. I'll have to send you guys a bottle of it. I gotta get rid of it somehow.
Yeah, what you need to do is put a picture of a goat puking on the label, and anyway. Well, guys, that's probably going to wrap it up for the show here tonight. Another Tuesday here at the Mead House. Sounds like we all got plenty of stuff going on. Like I needed more to add to my 30 gallons of stuff in the Mead House here. But fun show tonight. Next Tuesday is November 8th. So be sure to get out and vote for whomever you think you need to vote for. We'll be here on the air, keeping an eye on things, and I'm sure we'll come up with some more recipes, more to talk about between now and then. I wanted to throw a shout out to old Scott Monroe. I know you're hanging out there, bud. I see you. What do you say we all come back to the table next Tuesday night at about 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time? We'll do this all over again. So we'll see you then.